Luke 14:25 through 14:35, Carrying Your Cross, the sixth talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Ron Julian on November 4, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
At chapter 14 of Luke tonight, I'd like to just read the passage for you before we get too far. We're in chapter 14 of Luke, starting with verse 25. Now great multitudes were going along with him, with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. So, therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Therefore, salt is good, but if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Well, we have picked this passage as one of the essential passages for a Christian to understand. And maybe you see why and maybe you don't. But certainly we can see that something as important is at stake here. Jesus is giving us the conditions for being his disciple. He's saying, if you don't do this and you don't do this, you cannot be my disciple. And frankly, this passage can be pretty terrifying, actually, if you stop and read it carefully and take it seriously, because he's talking about some pretty demanding things, talking about hating your family and giving up all your possessions and carrying your cross, and that you have to do these things or you can't be his disciple. What exactly is all that about? The passage is so demanding that it has essentially created a rift in Christian theology. I mean, there are a lot of various ways that people look at things in Christian theology, but when it comes to a passage like this, we could say that there are these two generally recognizable positions that you have to take. On the one side, you can decide, okay, this means pretty much what it sounds like it's saying. No one can come to Jesus to be his disciple. No one can come to him. In other words, no one can come to him and find the salvation that he offers unless they hate their family, carry their cross, give up their possessions. That sounds so demanding and so difficult to understand that there is another side that would say, no, that can't be right. We're justified by faith and faith alone. It's not by my going out and doing acts of obedience and acts of righteousness that I'm going to be saved. It's by faith. So when Jesus says you can't be my disciple unless you do these things, what must be true then is that being a disciple is not necessary for being saved. Jesus is saying you can't be my disciple unless you hate your family and carry your cross and give up all your possessions. But do I have to be a disciple? this particular side of the question would say no. Being a disciple is an extra added thing. I hope that you can see that this is very important as to which way we go here. Because you and I have to do something with Jesus' statements. If we think that Jesus at all is the one to go to try to understand something about what life is about and where my own life is headed, he's making a very, very strong statement here. So I can't dodge it. One of those two things, not both of them can be right. Either this is a statement that describes what the person of God must be, or else it's optional. What are you going to do with a statement like this? Are you going to say, well, I'm happy enough to believe in Jesus and get saved, but I'm going to leave the discipleship to other people. I'm not strong enough to be a disciple. Being a disciple is for super Christians, those who are shooting for some really important place in the kingdom of God or looking for big rewards or something. I can't handle that stuff. I'll just have faith in Jesus, believe in him, get saved, and I'll leave being a disciple to someone else. Or has Jesus left you that option? Is that a position that you can take? Is he really saying that there is something non-negotiable? If you're going to come to him at all, you have to come to him in this way. We have to decide. I mean, if it is non-negotiable, then you and I had better come to terms with it. And I'll just tip my hand right up front. I believe and am firmly convinced that what he is saying is non-negotiable, that what he's saying here is something that each one of us has to confront. Am I going to hate my family, carry my cross, and give up all my possessions or not? And if I don't, then I have turned away from Jesus, and he will not be the Savior that I want him to be. To be saved is to be his disciple, and to be his disciple is to carry my cross. Having said that, though, I do believe in justification by faith, and I also think that we had better be careful to make sure that we understand what it is he's saying. When he says you'd better carry your cross, what does it mean to carry your cross? I mean, I've heard a lot of different answers given to that by people who oftentimes are trying to get me to do something. People who have some job that they want me to carry out that I don't want to do, and their answer to me is, you had better carry your cross. Well, I'm willing to do what Jesus tells me that I ought to do, but the place to start is to figure out, what is he telling me to do? What is this about? So that's what I want to talk about tonight, is this passage, this very powerful, confrontive, demanding passage. What is he confronting us with? What does he have on his mind? I think I understand what he's saying here. So I'm going to tell you what I think it means. And then you can disagree with me afterwards if you want. First of all, let's talk about this concept of being a disciple. Because one of the moves that people sometimes make is to try to distinguish somehow, you don't have to be a disciple to be a believer. If we were to go and to look at the way the word is used in the New Testament, there's really no evidence for that sort of thing at all. The word disciple comes from the cultural context where you have teachers referred to as rabbis from the Hebrew Aramaic. The idea is that there are these teachers, religious teachers, who had a certain way of looking at things. They understood the law in a certain way. They understood God in a certain way. And they gathered around themselves a group of students. And those students set out to understand what it is the teacher was teaching. Jesus was a rabbi in this sense. Everyone would have recognized this. He had a group of disciples, a group of people who lived with him, who followed him around, and who tried to understand what it was that he was teaching. There was the immediate group of the 12 who followed him kind of everywhere he went and worked with him. But there were many disciples that he had at the time, many people who followed him around, listened to his teaching, tried to figure out whether they were going to buy what he was teaching or not. So Jesus was an educator. He was teaching and saying, this is what's true, this is what you need to do, this is the way life is, and he had a group of people who were listening to him, trying to sort out what it meant. After Jesus left this earth, his apostles were given the assignment to go out and make disciples. And when we look at some of the language involved with that, the striking thing about it is they were supposed to go out and make disciples of Jesus. It's not that Paul was supposed to go out and make disciples of himself the way Jesus had disciples. John the Baptist had his own disciples. Lots of rabbis had disciples. But at this point, it was made clear, Jesus is saying to them, you're going out to make my disciples. You're going out to make disciples for me. And that's what they did. And when we find in the book of Acts, oftentimes, or several times, I should say, believers are just referred to as disciples. One of the most striking places is in Acts 11, where it says, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. And it's just a very simple, those who were the disciples, those who were the ones who were listening and trying to decide whether this Jesus really was the Messiah that he claimed to be, those are the disciples. Anyone is a disciple who hears the message and actually stops to listen to it and try to take it in and understand it and do something about it. If you hear the message that Jesus is teaching and his apostles are teaching and you stop to listen to it enough to try to understand it and embrace it yourself, then you're a disciple. That's what it means to be a disciple. So anyone who hears the message of salvation that Jesus brings, anyone who hears the message about his death on the cross and what that means, and anyone who listens to that message and tries to understand more about it and ultimately embraces it as true, that person is a disciple. I mean, it's really as simple as that. Rather than saying you can be a believer and not be a disciple, that kind of picture really has it switched around, because it's more accurate to say that you can be a disciple and not be a believer. We see that several times in the Gospels, where the disciples, as in those who are following around, listening to Jesus, trying to understand what he's teaching, they abandon him and basically say, we're not interested anymore. John 6 is one of those places. Many, therefore, of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it? And as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. And this is the place where Jesus asks Peter and the other disciples, so are you going to leave too? And Jesus receives the answer from them, where will we go? To whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. So Jesus had a whole bunch of disciples, but only some of them, after they heard what he had to say, hung around and actually embraced it and as their own, embraced it as their own belief. Jesus makes the comment in John 8, Jesus therefore was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You see what he's saying? You want to be my disciple, you need to abide in my word. That is, remain in my word. When I talk to you, when I tell you what it's all about, you don't back off like those other guys and say, no thanks, I think we're leaving. You hear it, you remain in it, you say it's true, you embrace it as true. If you do that, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. If you don't remain in my word, you hear what I have to say and decide that you're going to listen to something else, then you're not really a disciple of mine, and you're not going to come to know the truth, and the truth is not going to set you free. So, I think the biblical usage is pretty clear. Anyone who comes to Jesus to learn what he has to say about salvation and anything else he has to say is a disciple. And the true disciple is the one who heeds what Jesus says, embraces it, perseveres in it, believes it for his or herself. Okay. Now, so then when we come to this passage, and Jesus is talking about, in order to be my disciple, you have to do these things. I think there's some helpful background that we could bring to this that would help us with this particular passage. We're not going to be able to look at all this stuff by any means, but it's helpful to know that Jesus uses similar language, in particular the language about carrying your cross, the language about father and mother, about hating your life, and that kind of language. We find that in a couple of other contexts. And these contexts, I think, really help us to see what kind of thing Jesus has on his mind. One of the contexts is when Jesus sends out his 12 disciples to preach and do miracles and so on. He sends them out and he gives them this talk before they go out. And essentially what he says to them is, you know, you're going out as my representatives. And what you're going to find is that a lot of people don't like me. And you know what you're going to find out along with that? Since they don't like me, and you're going out as my representative, they're not going to like you either. That's what you're going to find out. The other context is when is a very famous scene where Jesus asks, who does everyone say I am? And then he asks Peter, who do you say I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of God. So it's this great scene of Peter's confession of who Jesus is, which is immediately followed up by Jesus saying that he's going to have to go and die. And Peter says, oh no, that could never be, you know, that can never happen. And Peter, who just got praised by Jesus turns to him and says, get thee behind me, Satan. So it's one of the quickest sort of emotional turnarounds probably anyone ever had. I've always felt for Peter in that situation, you know. Jesus has just held me up as you know, having said this great thing, and then I just put my foot right in it and go right down. Well, the talk that Jesus gives after that, when Peter says, oh no, you know, they're going to kill you. No, 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 this is not the way it's going to be, is again a talk about what following Jesus is all about and how the world hates him and how if you're going to follow him, you're going to have to put up with the hatred of the world around you because there are going to be those times when the world around you does not approve of what you stand for because you're a follower of Jesus. Both of the contexts where Jesus talks about carrying your cross and hating your family and hating your life and all of that language, both of the other contexts very, very clearly are about how are you, my disciples, going to respond when the world responds to you the way it responds to me? How are you going to respond? What are you going to do when you discover that following me means that you're going to be less popular than you used to be in some way or another? That's what those contexts are about. It's very helpful, I think, to see that because that, I believe, is exactly what the issue is as well in this section where Jesus is using the same kind of language. Basically, there are a series of themes that Jesus teaches in these other contexts that are very helpful to see in this one. He taught that the world would reject him and that the disciples would experience the same rejection. Jesus taught that the disciples should not fear, even if they face rejection, even if it should result in their death. And one of these contexts is the place where Jesus says, essentially, why should you fear them? All they can do is kill you. Jesus says especially you should not let the fear of what they might do to you keep you from confessing me. That is, you've got this choice. You're kind of on trial. The world's looking at you and it's saying, whose side are you on? And Jesus is saying, at that spot, what you had better do is say, I'm on Jesus' side. Because if you don't, then when it comes time for Jesus to say later on whether he's on your side or not, he's going to say, I'm sorry, I don't know the guy. Very important, very striking statement. And finally, in these contexts, Jesus is teaching them that they have to make a choice about ultimately where their life is to be found. And here's what I mean. If by following Jesus, I'm gaining the disapproval of the world around me, That means that in significant ways, I stand to lose in this life. I stand to lose approval. I stand to lose money, maybe. I stand to lose position in the community. Or I stand to lose the affection of my family. There are all kinds of ways in which I might lose in following Jesus, he's saying. But what do I want in the end? Do I want what I can get out of this life now? If I do, then pretty stupid thing to follow Jesus because it's going to cost me. Now, well, we can talk at the end. There are ways of following Jesus that don't cost you anything in this world, and they're not as valuable in the end for solving your eternal problem. But we're talking about that genuine embracing the Jesus who is and what he actually taught. In this world, sooner or later, you're going to end up paying a cost. And what he's trying to get his disciples to see is you've got to make a decision. If you're going to go with me, you may very well end up losing something in this world. And the question is, do you recognize that what you lose is nothing in comparison with what you're gaining? He's putting it right out there and saying, look, what you're gaining out of this is incomparably better than what you're losing. So that's the wise choice. Now, that's what those passages that we're not looking at tonight, that's what those passages basically are saying. I'm saying, I'm just summing them up and saying that's what those passages are talking about. If we understand that, then that's very helpful as we come to the passage in Luke 14, because I would say that's exactly the issue that we see with each one of these statements. When he says, in order to be my disciple, you have to do this. That's the kind of setting that we're talking about. For instance, it starts out by saying, he turned and said to the multitudes who were coming along with him, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Well, obviously, this is a very strange thing. Jesus knows that he's saying something very provocative when he says this. I mean, your immediate thought is, well, do I have to hate them all the time? Or is it all right to like them sometimes? Or, I mean, what exactly are you getting at here? It's helpful if we look at one of those parallel passages where he teaches something similar, but he spells it out a little more clearly. This is from Matthew 10. Let me just read you a couple of verses here. You don't need to turn to it. When he sends out the 12, he says, look, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Hopefully it's a little clearer when we look at that he's picturing a scenario in which the message which he brings comes into the very fabric of a family, and one part of that family embraces it, and the other part of that family rejects it. That's what he's saying. In a sense, I didn't come to bring peace. Now, obviously, he did come to bring peace. I mean, ultimately, his purpose is to solve the problem of sin in the world and to ultimately eliminate the animosity that so easily characterizes our relations with each other. But here he's talking about an unavoidable sort of animosity, that there's going to come this place where someone who embraces the teaching of Jesus is going to find those who do not embrace that teaching and who reject him because of it. And rejection, as we can talk about, can take many forms. I mean, we don't necessarily have to be talking about persecution and death in the sense of something ultimate, although in many cultures and at many times that's exactly what it has meant for someone who becomes a believer. But what we're talking about is the fact that in this world, we have developed a set of assumptions by which we operate. Those assumptions saying, this is all there is. You and I have a sort of a tacit agreement about how we're going to do things and what we're going to say is good and what we're going to say is bad. And there comes this place where the message of the cross is offensive. Maybe it's the part that says that I am a sinner who does not deserve the kindness of God. That's a strong statement. I don't know if you noticed this weekend, but we had Rabbi Lappin here, who was a very interesting speaker, and I'm glad we brought him. But one of the things we discovered in kind of exploring a little bit some of the theological differences and thinking about things is that he was quite willing to talk about sin and evil in the world and recognize that he himself was not what he ought to be and striving against the downward pull in himself. And all of those things he would acknowledge, but he would not acknowledge that those things merited the condemnation of God. The idea of an eternal judgment of some sort, either, well, I mean, however you picture what that judgment would be, the fact that God would look at me and say, this is evil, this is to be rejected, that picture was so foreign and offensive to him that when we brought it up, it was like, whoa, like, you guys believe that? That is really weird. So, but that is absolutely a part of the message that Jesus came to bring. When we look at the cross of Jesus, it only makes sense in the light of a teaching that says, if God were to be just, then we would be struck down. Not just cleaned up, but struck down. Christian theology teaches that if God were just, we would be struck down. And Jesus is at the heart of that. That's exactly what he said. That's offensive. And so there are people who, when we come to embrace that idea, are offended by it even because of what it would imply about themselves. And there are other aspects of it. There's an implicit criticism in what Jesus, not just implicit, fairly explicit criticism in Jesus' teaching about many of the things in the world and the way we do things. To embrace the teaching of Jesus is to say about many things in the world, it shouldn't be that way. And there are going to be a lot of people who are going to reject, be offended, be angry, be indifferent, whatever, to that message because they do not like the idea that someone would look at something in their world and say, it shouldn't be that way, especially if it has anything to do with the way they conduct themselves. So there are a lot of reasons why the message of Jesus can be offensive to people, but it is offensive to people. What Jesus said is, you need to recognize that this message is offensive to people, and if you're going to follow me, that means you're going to have to take it. There's really no choice. I'm going that way, and you're going to find a lot of people who are going that way, and they're not going to like it when you won't go with them. You have to decide ultimately, where is your life? What is it that you want? In the passage I'm reading from Matthew, he says, he who has found his life shall lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it. This classic sort of inversion, very, very popular in the Bible, this sort of, if you've got it, you lose it, if you lose it, you'll get it kind of language. But look at what he's saying. The one who has found his life, and the idea is, I see my place in the world as my little niche. This is the spot where I'm making my stand. This is the place that is going to fulfill me. This is the place that is going to give me what I'm looking for. And so if I dig in here and say, this is it, I grab a hold of it and say, I've got it, then Jesus is saying, you're going to lose it. In the end, you won't have anything. But it's the one who looks at what he has in this life and is willing to recognize, no, this isn't it yet. This is not what I'm going to take my stand on. This is not where my ultimate fulfillment is to be found. The one who lets go and says, no, this isn't it, is the one who will find his life. In the end, he will find that which really is life and really is fulfilling. I point to that passage because it helps us to understand his language when he says that you need to hate your father and mother and even your own life. When he says hating your life, hating your family now, he doesn't mean... He's using a very striking phrase to get our attention. He doesn't mean I'm supposed to go around saying, I hate my life, I hate my job, I hate my children, I hate my wife, I hate my hair, I hate my clothes. I mean, that's not spirituality in biblical terms. What he's getting at is there comes this place where the decision I make as to what I love and to what I hate comes down to what is the thing that I'm going to embrace and say this is the bottom line for me. If I say to someone in my family who will not go with me into the journey of faith, I'm sorry, but this is too important. This is what my life is about. I know you're not going there, but I'm going there. And the fact that you disapprove is not going to deter me from going there. Then in a sense, I have loved something else more than this person in my family. And from their perspective, Jack has made the comment, and maybe this is right. Maybe this is where Jesus gets this idea. Certainly the person on the other side feels as if they're being treated hatefully. How could you treat me this way? How could you belittle my values by embracing something so obviously wrong or something like that? At any rate, he's not talking about acting hatefully. This is the same Jesus who argued that the commandment about honoring your father and your mother is something that needs to be kept. I mean, I'm not free to hate anyone in the sense of acting unlovingly toward them, unkindly toward them, to act without compassion, to act against their best interests. That's not at all what he has in mind. But it's that idea, what is it that you love and what do you hate? It's the thing you love is the thing that you grab, and the thing that you hate is the thing that you let go of. Because I can't hold on to this because I've got to have this. That's the kind of imagery that he's using. Have you found your life, or will you lose your life so that you can find it? That's the idea that he's talking about. In the context of families in particular, we're talking about whatever benefits there are to gain in this life from having that sense of secure acceptance from maybe parents, maybe a spouse, maybe extended family. I mean, there's that place of security. It's one of the, when it works, it's one of the most secure places that we human beings can find to be within the affection and acceptance of a family group. So it's saying something for Jesus to come along and saying, I'm talking about a loyalty that goes beyond that family group. I'm talking about a security that's better than the security you can find in that family group. And ultimately, when they come to know that my approval means more to you than theirs, they may not like it. But where are you going to go with that? He's saying, you can't be my disciple and love them more than me. Because as soon as you start learning from me, the potential for that break is there. And if you're going to keep following me, then that's what's going to happen. So, he goes on to say then, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. This verse has been used for so many things, I think, in the history of the church. And so many things that finally I sat down with it to try to understand what is it that Jesus is talking about here, because I've had so many admonitions given to me. I have a friend who comments that every time he goes and visits a new church, it seems like the pastor is giving a sermon about carrying your cross. And then it often seems like there's a building fund or something happening at the same time that sort of goes along with it. The idea that somehow what I'm called on, what Jesus is saying is, I need to get in there and self-sacrificially work to build up the church or something like that might be what carrying your cross is all about. But I think we can do better than that. I think we can get closer to what it is that he's actually talking about if we remember a couple of things. First of all, maybe this phrase will capture it for me. This phrase captures for me what I'm talking about, is a cross is not what you use to commit suicide. You don't commit suicide with a cross. A cross is something that somebody else nails you to. The whole point of the cross was it was an instrument of execution. Jesus had not gone to the cross when he said this, but his disciples knew what a cross was. You get arrested by the Romans, and capital punishment is the result. What are they going to do? They're going to take you out, they're going to hang up the cross, they're going to nail you to it until you die. So when he talks about carrying your cross, they were all very familiar with the picture of the condemned criminal carrying the cross out to the place of execution where he was going to be killed. When we remember that in all three of the contexts, especially the two that we're not looking at here, the others that I mentioned, when he sends out his disciples and when he tells Peter about how the necessity that he's going to be killed and so on. Both of those contexts are talking about what is the world going to do to you? What sort of a response are you going to get out there? So it seems pretty clear to me that carrying your cross, the way he's talking about it, is having that willingness to take on the disapproval of the world. In one context, he makes that statement about being willing even to die. What would be a big deal if the world was to kill you in comparison with the God who can send you into hell, he says. Whose disapproval matters more, God's disapproval or the world's disapproval? What can the world do to me in comparison with what God can do to me? I mean, if we put it on those terms. Why would I fear the world around me? So carrying your cross, as he is using it here, is right in keeping with the context of, am I looking for the approval of the world? This is my life. I'm going to grab a hold of it. I'm going to have this life now, and I'm going to make sure that this life is for me what I want it to be by making sure that I have the approval that I want of the people around me. Or else, have I let go of my life and said, this is not ultimately what is going to satisfy me, and so even if I lose it, I'm not really losing anything ultimately, and so I'm going to carry my cross, this picture of the implement of the world rendering judgment on me and maybe even costing me my life. Carrying my cross is my willingness to pay whatever price it costs to follow Jesus. If my family doesn't like me, I'll accept their dislike. If the government says I have to die, I'll die. I mean, whatever the cost is, whatever it is that the world around me says about my following Jesus, I'm going to follow him anyway. That's what he's getting at. That's what the issue is here. In a sense, it's very simple. In a sense, it's very profound, because the question is, what is it that I find ultimately fulfilling? What is it that I think that I have to have? Now, I'm gonna jump over the stories here to, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about them for just a minute. But he tells a couple of stories, a couple of parables about a guy building a tower, about a guy going into battle against a king. And at the end of these stories, he says, "So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." I think, mistakenly, people have sometimes a tendency to equate this verse with another place where Jesus is talking to the rich young ruler, and they're talking about the rich young ruler asks him, "How do you inherit eternal life? And Jesus says, basically, "Look, what I want you to do is sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me." That, I would argue, is a specific piece of advice that he gave to a specific person who essentially loved his money. And he basically just sort of confronted with him, "Okay, I'll tell you what you do. Follow me. Get rid of everything you've got and follow me." I do not believe that the Bible teaches that discipleship, following Jesus, means necessarily that you have to sell everything you have and possess nothing. That is not the picture that we have when we look at the New Testament. That's not the way the apostles apply Jesus' teaching on this stuff. Nowhere do they say you have to give up everything. And there are many examples of people having things, possessing things, people working. Paul is telling people, you know, if you don't work, you won't eat. I want you to work and make enough money so that you can take care of your needs and have some to give other people who are in trouble. So, Jesus, I would argue, is not saying here, "I want you to sell everything you have, possess nothing, and if you don't sell everything you have, if you hold on to anything at all that is actually yours and you haven't sold to anybody else, then you can't be my disciple." That's not what he means. He means something, in a sense, even more radical than that. This is his conclusion. He said, "Look, you have to hate your mother and father and even your life. You have to carry your cross. Let me tell you a couple stories. So therefore, you have to give up your possessions." And if we were to look at literally at what he says, it's something more like what he's saying is, "I want you, in order to be my disciple, you have to say goodbye to all that is yours." See, this includes, in this context, this includes the father, the mother. This includes my life. It's not that I'm not allowed to have clothes while I'm living on this earth, but the idea is that it's not just my possessions. That's a little bit misleading way to translate it. This word is, it's my stuff. All that is mine. Say goodbye to your life. Say goodbye to all that is yours, is what he's saying. That essentially, if there's anything that I have in my life, that means more to me than what God has promised me in the kingdom of God and what Jesus has come to accomplish in my life, then I can't be his disciple, he's saying. Because if you're going to learn from me, one of the first lessons I'm teaching you is, I've got something different and better than what this life is about. So, the very act of believing in Jesus, the very act of looking and saying, "Yes, I recognize I'm a sinner. I recognize that I need to be saved. I recognize that the promise of God for an eternal life freed from sin and death," all of that confronts me with a truth that I have to decide. Is this true or not? Do I believe it or don't I believe it? Does it mean anything to me or not? Do I want it or do I not want it? So, rather than picturing Jesus as saying there's some strict test you've got to pass in order to get saved or something like that, he's just laying out the very logical choices that you have to make. As soon as you start embracing the gospel, you're going to find yourself at odds with the world around you. What Jesus is calling us to is a set of values, a set of beliefs, and a set of truths that are different than what most of the people around me have embraced. And because that's true, there are going to be those times when it's going to cost me. And we can put that in various ways. If I'm dealing with family members, then it's going to cost me their affection, and thus, in order to follow Jesus, I have to hate them. I'm going to receive disapproval even to the point of death. So I have to carry my cross. I'm going to find that following Jesus and trying to make a place for yourself in this world where everything is the way you want it, those things are working at cross purposes. So in order to follow him, I have to say goodbye to my life. I have to say goodbye to what is mine. That is, what is mine in this world? Whatever I've been able to put together for myself in this world, I have to look at it and say, it's not enough. It doesn't mean that I have to walk away from it. If I have a job, desert and stare at the sun or something like that. Or yeah, good, that's right. It's not that. It's that I have said goodbye to it in the sense that whenever I come to that place where I recognize that following the call of Jesus toward salvation is getting me in trouble in this world, losing me something in this world, I confront that choice and say, well, the fact is, I want what he's promised me more than I want the approval of the world around me, or the riches of the world around me, the respect of the world around me, whatever it might be. That's the choice that I confront. So, frankly, I think what Jesus is describing here is at the heart of what it means to be a disciple. That my life as a believer now is about confronting these choices. Certainly, I would say, we could flip through the New Testament, page after page after page, and I would argue that essentially what you'll find the message to be in Jesus, in Paul, in the book of Acts, in John's writing, in Peter's writing, James, Hebrews, it keeps coming back to the same thing. There is a truth that God has told us about who we are and who he is and what is really valuable. And my life is about confronting that truth and deciding whether I believe it or not and acting on that belief. I act on it very imperfectly because I'm a sinner. I act foolishly many times. One of the difficulties about a passage like this is that Jesus is speaking in very categorical terms. I would remind you what I think is very helpful. I often refer to this because knowing myself the way I do, I have to find my heroes and pick them carefully. And one of my great heroes in the Bible is Peter, because Jesus told Peter right to his face, essentially, in a context very similar to this one, "You deny me before men, and I'll deny you before my Father." And I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but when Jesus was arrested, 3 times people came to Peter and said, "Aren't you with him?" And he said, "No, I don't know the guy. Leave me alone." In other words, he denied Jesus before men. So one of the very helpful things about that is to recognize that although Jesus speaks in very strong terms, and he means what he says, he does not mean it's one strike and you're out. What he means is that in my life, as I seek to be a disciple of Jesus, I'm going to confront these kinds of issues. I can't avoid them. And it's undoubtedly true that I am going to make mistakes. I'm going to end up doing the very things that he tells me that I shouldn't do. But it's all in a part of that struggle to sort out who am I and what do I really want. Ultimately, Jesus in this kind of teaching is saying the path goes that way. And I can't really change things for you. I can't tell you that there's a nice, easier path over here that you can take instead. There's only one path. It's a very narrow gate, he says. There are very few who find it, and it's a tough one. Because you go down that path, and everybody who's not on that path, sooner or later, has the potential to become your enemy. It can happen. It does happen. What are you going to do with that, he's saying. To be my disciple is to inherit the world's attitude towards me. There's really nothing that's going to change that. That's what he's saying. That's why he says this to the multitude that was following him. He's basically trying to say to them, you know, there's more to following me than just following me around and listening to what I say. Sooner or later, you're going to have to decide whether you want this, whether you believe what I'm saying. And let me tell you, when you do, in this world, it's not necessarily going to be pretty for you. I've left two parts of this passage out because we really don't have the time to talk about them. One of them are these two parables that he mentions, and one at the end is the thing about the salt. Both of them fit in to this context very well, I think. I've got a couple of minutes before we stop for questions. I thought I would just run past you for something to think about, a possibility about how you might go away and think about these parables. I don't know how many of you have ever read the parables of Jesus. I have always been very interested in the parables of Jesus. I think they're great. They're provocative. They're very interesting and have been very, very challenging to me in my life. The parables of Jesus have been one of those parts of the Bible that have really gotten my attention and gotten in my face at a number of places. These two parables here are very tricky, I think. They seem very simple. There's a very common way of understanding them. I mean, we have this story about a guy who builds a tower, discovers he doesn't have enough to complete it. He set out to build the tower, but he didn't have enough money to finish the tower. And so then everybody makes fun of him when he's done. And then we have a story about a king who wants to go to battle with another king. And he says, what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. And what I just want to say quickly, I'm not going to explain this whole thing because we don't have time, but I just want to give you something to go away and think about. The common way of understanding these parables, and maybe it's right, is to say what Jesus is saying is you need to understand how difficult it is to be a disciple. You don't want to start into being my disciple and then discover halfway there that you don't have what it takes, because that would be embarrassing. So you need to know right away that it's tough. And essentially, the stories are saying you need to sit down and decide whether you have what it takes, and if you don't have what it takes, you ought to give up before you start. That's the part that has always bothered me about these stories, is it's just almost impossible for me to imagine that Jesus would give the advice, when I set out to be his disciple, I should look at myself and try to decide if I have what it takes to go the distance. And if I don't have what it takes, I should give up. Because I think many, many people have become disciples of Jesus at a spot where they would have to honestly say, I don't know whether I have what it takes. I don't know whether I'm going to go the distance or not. So the parable seems to be suggesting you ought to give up. If you're not sure, you're going to be embarrassed if you get halfway down the road and you don't make it all the way. So better to give up in advance. That doesn't make any sense to me. Now, maybe you could find a way to make that make sense, and I'd be willing to listen. But in thinking about these parables, it struck me that there's another way to think about them, and I think this way makes a lot more sense in this context, and I just want to leave you with this thought. Especially if you go and you look at the story about the king, let's forget about this common understanding about, you know, what this story is about. If you just read it for its the story itself, he says, what king wouldn't do this? He's saying, isn't this what a king would do? He wants to go in battle against this other guy, but he sits down and he realizes that he only has half the forces that the other guy has. So he wisely, instead of going out and going to battle with him, he wisely gives up and seeks terms of peace beforehand. That's what the story says. I mean, if you look at it just on its own terms, the story seems to be commending the king. I mean, what idiot would go to battle against a king who's got twice as many forces as you've got? He says, if you know you're going to lose, then what you do is you sit down and you come to terms with the guy before you go to battle. Likewise, the one who builds the tower, it's a little harder to see there, but the same thing. If you look in your wallet and say, I don't have enough money to build a tower, then why would you set out to build the tower? Why don't you stop before you start, before you get to that spot where it's too late? You've committed yourself, you built this tower halfway, and everybody sees that you can't do the job. Well, the question I asked myself is, would it be possible that this is the point that Jesus is making? That the story is intended to say, the king is wise to give up. He's wise to recognize that he doesn't have what it takes to finish the job, and he gives up before he ever goes into battle. And one of the striking things about the story to me was when he talks about that language about... I should never have taken off my glasses, excuse me. He sits down to see whether he is strong enough to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000, or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. And what struck me is, this is a striking sort of analogy for our situation with God. That is, there is this day coming when God is going to come here and come to terms with me. I'm going to have to, on the day when Jesus returns, I am going to come before the judgment seat of God, and I'm going to have to give an accounting for what I'm doing. But while he's far away, what I need to do is I need to come to terms with him now. I need to come to terms with him before he gets here. When he gets here to judge my life, it's going to be too late. The time that I need to come to terms with him is now. And what I need to recognize is that if I think that someday I'm going to do battle with him and win, I'm crazy. I'm going to lose that battle. Better to give up now and recognize that I can't win and come to terms before it's too late. In that sense, then, if that's what Jesus is saying, then what he's getting at is, we have this idea, we would like to cling to our life. We would like to look at what we have in this world and say, this is mine, this is where I'm going to make my stand, this is where it's all going to work. But the fact is, if I think it's going to work, I'm an idiot. It is not going to work. What I ought to do is be like the guy who looks in his wallet and says, I don't have enough to build this tower. Or like the guy who looks at his armies and says, I don't have the forces to battle with the other guy. Look at it and say, this is not going to work, and give up now. Essentially, abandoned my allegiance to the life that I have now. Say, I can't retain it, I can't keep it, I can't make it work. And admit that my opponent in God is got me beat. He's going to win. So why not come to terms with him now before it comes to battle and I really get beat up? So Jesus' advice is here, then I ought to be like these guys. They're smart. They gave up in advance. They gave up recognizing that they can't do it. And what I ought to do, I think is what he's saying, is I ought to give up now. I ought to recognize that this world cannot make a real and fulfilling life for me. It cannot solve my problem. Riches can't do it. The approval of the world around me can't do it. Nothing can do it. I need to assess the situation realistically now, and thus, he says, say goodbye to my life. Therefore, no one could be my disciple who doesn't say goodbye to his life. Look at it and say, I can't keep it, I can't make it work, I renounce it. It's not going to do it for me. I'll take the life that you have to offer instead. Okay, well, what we're going to do now is have questions. This is an opportunity for anyone who would like to quietly and with dignity and decorum, get up and leave the room, trying to look very interested as you leave so that the teacher doesn't feel rejected while you're doing it. And Meanwhile, the rest of us will have a time for questions and comments.
That made a lot of sense, especially helped your explanation of the first part of the section that you read in Luke 14 about hating your mother and your brother and your children and all
right.
those things. I mean, that very striking language that typically we tend to read literally and don't know what to do with.
We don't know what to do with.
I really like that. I was reminded of a similar interpretation or a similar verse elsewhere. I don't know where it is. Maybe you could tell me. But the whole, where Jesus uses the language about, you know, if your right arm causes you to stumble, cut it off. And if your eye causes you to pluck it out and all that kind of stuff. But there again, you have an example of this really strong and similar language being used about, you know, if this is happening, then it sounds like an if-then statement. You know, if this is happening, then you need to do this. And you kind of go, well, that, you know, that you can't read that literally. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because the fact of the matter is I'm hacking off every part of my body, because every part is causing me to stumble. So, but it's more he's using this strong language to suggest the idea that, you know, if a part of your anatomy, whatever it is causing you to stumble, at something that is so much a part of you, we should have this attitude towards sin and to be so abhorred by it and so turned shut off by it that if something so close and so intimate and so connected with us as our hand is the problem, the tool or something like that, the means that's causing us to sin, we ought to be willing to sever it. We ought to be willing to cut it off. He's not saying that you have to go do that.
He's not saying that actually
would solve the problem to cut my hand off, because it come to recognize pretty soon that doesn't solve the problem.
So I was just reminded of that.
I think you're right.
There's a similar kind of way of taking the, I mean, the really strong language that Jesus is using to get at an attitude rather than an actual behavioral
And this is not actually uncommon among,
this kind of sort of hyperbolic language, and speaking very striking, in-your-face sort of statements. There are other examples from the time of teachers doing that kind of thing. I mean, it's not evading what he's saying to stop and ask the question, what does he mean by that? I'm not dodging it and making it less than what it was, because he meant it to be provocative. He meant it to get in my face and make me think, now what does he mean by that? Because he's counting on me to know that he is the one who upheld the importance of something like honoring your father and your mother, even as he's talking about how I need to hate them. So he's counting on me to stop and think about it, and to recognize that if I were to go around hating all of the people in my family in the way we think about it, if I was to go around treating them poorly and despising them in my heart, that I would be actually very disobedient to what the Bible is calling me to. But so if I'm going to be foolish about it, if I'm just going to, you know, not stop and think about it, then I'm going to get myself in a lot of trouble. Yeah.
I like it out in left field, and every once in a while I like to toss a ball in and see if it's caught. So I'm wondering if maybe you could comment on this.
Okay.
In regards to hatred.
Okay.
I used to always see it as, you know, the Jewish form of communication, hyperbole. Mm-hmm. Until I really did a study on love. And the study, of course, had me study the subject of hatred. And in the New Testament here, other places in the New Testament, but especially in the Old, in Psalms, the prophet says, hate evil, love good. David says, you know, trying to commend himself to God. He says, do I not hate those who hate you? And I started thinking about it and realized that in a world of good and evil, where there's there's evil to hate and there's good to love. and man has the knowledge of good and evil, defining for himself what that is. There is naturally hatred in response to what threatens that which you love. Therefore, the opposite of love is not hatred, it's indifference. And I know this is this next part is really anathema. And as eminent Bible scholars, C.S. Lewis, look at David's imprecatory psalms and say, well, David was really fleshly at this time. This was an expression of his sin. But it seems to me, that if you love something and that something that is loved is threatened, the response is hatred. And the opposite of love is just not to care. Therefore, I really liked your interpretation and how you gave it in the context of the persecution of the world. And that persecution is really strong in the family. I don't see that as hyperbole. I see that we have difficulty because we don't know how to love with a godly love, and we don't know how to hate with a godly hatred. But if the kingdom of God is threatened by something as intimate as your family, you had better respond with a godly hatred, or you're walking on dangerous ground.
Okay, well, I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean. I can go quite a ways with you, I think. I don't have a problem with what you said about the imprecatory psalms. I don't agree with C.S. Lewis that this is David at his worst. I mean, I think the judgments that David calls down upon the enemies of God, I think you're right. They arise out of a righteous regard for what is good and a recognition that here is someone standing against God and what is good. I don't have a problem with that. I don't think the imprecatory psalms are ultimately an embarrassment. They're a part of the same Bible that has God saying, you know, that He is going to deal with evil.
Quite decisively.
Right. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with that. And I don't. What you say about a godly hatred, I guess we'd have to flesh that out. I would be prepared to go with you there. What I meant when I said, maybe I'm not being very precise in the way I'm talking about this. If I use the word hate, I hate someone, typically the associations that we bring with that are I condemn them, I would seek to do harm to them if I could, that sort of thing.
Fleshly hatred. Right. There's a fleshly love, too.
Right.
That's just as destructive as a fleshly hatred.
Right. So, I've got room, I think, for the kind of idea that you're talking about if we dial into it along with the picture that Jesus told me that I'm supposed to love my enemies.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which I would hate the enemies of God, but there's a sense in which I love them.
Well, there's room for a book there, you know, okay. Because the Bible says love your enemies. It says that in the law. It says if your enemy's donkey wanders away, don't let it wander away. Take it back to him. It didn't say take it back to him and then throw rocks at him when he comes out to get him.
Right.
It says love your enemies.
Right. Oh, but I challenge you guys to find a publisher for that book.
Well, you won't find it. But really, love hasn't even been defined.
Right.
Love. Our conception of love is so nebulous.
Right.
It's terrible, you know.
Right.
And so, let alone define hatred.
Right.
You know.
However, I do when you look at these, I do want to maintain that in these contexts, when he talks about hating my life or loving my life and that sort of stuff, I don't think that he's primarily talking about pronouncing judgment on evil in my life or something like that. Because what he's talking about as being my life is like what he calls my possessions. I'm seeing him talking about what I have in this world. If the persecution comes and they say anyone who is following Jesus will be shot, and I say, oh no, I don't want to follow Jesus. In the biblical terms, I have loved my life. Meaning, I have embraced it. I said, no, this is what I've got to have. And likewise, if I were to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm following Jesus. If you have to take my life, then that's what you're going to do. Then in those terms, I have loved Jesus and I have hated my life. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's the terminology, the way he's using it here. I don't necessarily disagree with the point you're making, but I think the concept here is not so much a hatred of evil as it is the question of what is the thing that I value? What is the thing that I cling to and say, this is the thing I've got to have? No, I have to have the approval of my family, or no, I have to have the kingdom of God.
I say that's a shelter that's commonly run to when I do bring up the subject. You hate the sin but love the sinner. And I still haven't found anyone who can tell me what they mean by that. And David said, "Do not I hate those who hate you." It's like when I put my kid down on the bed. Well, I had two reasons I would do this. Two laws in my family that would cause this. One is if he ever got caught in a lie, and one if they didn't submit to a lesser form of punishment. But if they violated those two, I'd sit them down and I'd lay him down and I'd wail on him, just protecting the small of his back. And at that moment, I hated what he did because I hate lying and I hate rebellion against authority. And God's done that many times to me, quite literally, if you've got spiritual eyes. But see, my love for him and my hatred for him and what he did, that's simultaneous. And I think we're anemic and we lack passion and we just come off cerebral and without soul if we do not know how to love with a passion and we don't know how to hate with a passion.
Okay, all I'm saying is in the passage that we're talking about here, the issue you're talking about, I think, is not the issue. I'm not saying I don't agree. Whether or not the way you've put things together is the way things are, I'm prepared to go there. We'd have to talk more about what you mean. But what I'm saying is, in this section, I don't think that's what the word hate and love are talking about. Whether other passages are saying the kind of thing that you're saying, I'm still open
okay.
to that.
I'll just get it in. He who phileos father or mother over or above me is not worthy of me. I mean, in that context, you're talking about love. And if your family is coming at you and using their intimacy and authority to intimidate you to leave Jesus, then I believe that hatred is the proper response. That's where I tie it in. And that's why, I know I'm way out in left field, but... I've examined the scriptures, and I don't think that's hyperbole. I think that's a godly response. Sorry about that.
No,
I
it's fine.
People,
no,
no wonder they kicked me out.
No, I don't have a whole lot of problem with what you're saying. I still don't think that's the issue in this passage, but I don't have a lot of problem with that idea, if I understand what you mean. But I'm not sure I do. But I think I could understand what you're saying in a way that I could agree with. At least let me put it that way. Does anybody else have a?
Beginning of your talk, you said that the way some people go wrong in this passage is to say that discipleship is different than Billy. Mm-hmm. That what Jesus is saying, is laying out, is if you want to go further in your Christian walk, this is what you have to do.
Right.
Belief is just having faith in the
right. Gospel.
So those who lay out this as an alternative,
right.
How do they express, what form does this discipleship take? Hating your parents?
No, I don't think so. I think, they would do the typical, not putting them above Jesus and that kind of stuff. But see, they're saying something pretty profound. They're saying, all I have to do to be saved is to believe that Jesus died for my sins. I don't have to follow him. I don't have to be his disciple. I don't have to put him, the kingdom of God, as being more important than the things of this world. I can live in this world, revel in this world, want the things of this world, not really value the things of the kingdom of God. But if I believe in Jesus for my salvation, then I'll be saved. But what then happens is I don't get, maybe a lot of times they talk about it in terms of rewards. I'm going to get there and he's going to say, well, you didn't do a very good job, so you have to sweep up. Or something like that. So what I'm saying is that is, however they put it together, that is not how I understand what is happening here. And it's really a council of despair. They're just trying to find a way to avoid. Their doctrine says that the only passages that talk about salvation are things like, the end of John, where he says, I've written these things so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, and the believing you may have life in his name. That's a salvation verse, and nothing, the whole bunch of other things. Never mind that Jesus in John talks about, not seeking after glory from men, or not seeking after the bread that can't give you life instead of the bread that can, and all of that kind of stuff. Those are other issues of obedience and discipleship and that kind of stuff. All you have to do is believe in Jesus. So
that's the thing that I find. I never thought about it this way before, but in terms for illustration purposes, if you were to take all the scriptures in the New Testament, and if you were able to cut them up, you could have two bins. One would be the bin of the scriptures that would talk about salvation, and then there's the other bin of scriptures that would talk about how to be a good Christian, or how to be a proper Christian, or the way to view Christianity, sanctification. These scriptures are about sanctification, and these scriptures are about salvation. And as I listen to you speak, I'm slowly starting to take these scriptures and pick them up out of this bin and put them over here in this bin. Meaning, some of these scriptures seem to be talking about sanctification, but what you're saying is that more and more of these scriptures that seem to be talking about sanctification are really getting at the heart of what it means to be a believer.
Right. It's the whole picture of sanctification in the Bible is not some addition to that I can add on to being a believer. It is the very working out of the being a believer in the midst of life. That's what sanctification is. It's the thing that I believe moving from my mouth and my head to the actual life that I'm living. But the very simple biblical message is a faith that hasn't moved into your life, it doesn't exist. You can't believe stuff that you don't live. That's not the kind of belief that we're talking about. So I'm pretty radical about that stuff, actually, Roger. The two piles you're talking about, at this point, I have moved all of them out of that pile. I don't have any left in a pile that says, this is sanctification. This doesn't have anything to do with...
The picture that came to my mind is you don't have to separate the Bible into separate cans before you put them out on the curb. It all comes with one can.
That's right.
Well, shall we call it a night? Okay, we will.